I wanted to thank everyone, particularly the Rushy Colo and other leaders for inviting me. I have to tell you, I'll try to speak better. The problem is if I face this way, these people can't hear you. I have to tell you, the part of it was my son would not let me not join you tonight. I have a son who spent a few weeks in Norfolk on two occasions, and he developed such close relationships with people there.
What's your son's name?
Yaakov. So he went down, you know, there's a well-known speech therapy program. So my son...
He stayed at my house.
There you go. But I want you to know, to show you how warm he felt toward the Norfolk community, he had an off Shabbos 2 weeks ago, and I asked him, so you coming home? He said, no, I want to go to Norfolk.
Wow.
So it didn't work out in the end, but... And I know that he keeps up still with people there, so obviously it says a lot about the community. And you know, he's an 18-year-old boy, so you know there aren't that many things that you know. Yaakov Cohen. He stayed at the Weinerbs, and then he stayed at your house.
Yeah,
Schwartz.
I remember.
Yeah. Well, you, afterwards, you'll tell me if he goofed around.
How's his speech?
He was, but there's a speech therapy program that he went down there for. I asked him if I could say that, you know, and he said yes, so that's why he went there. Very good. Very good. It required a lot of work during and afterwards, so... anyway, so I want to thank everybody, and I'm happy to be here. I just wanted to say I'm the Washington director for Agudath Israel of America, which commonly is referred to as the Agudah. And what I do is I've been in this position for 28 years. It's a long time. And we were the first, we meaning the Agudah was the first Orthodox Jewish organization to open up a Washington office. And since then, others have joined in, but when we started, a lot of people looked on to see whether we would be successful or not. You know, we, meaning the Orthodox community, had never had that kind of aggressive presence in Washington. And the question was, did we have the political culture and sophistication to carry on that kind of work face to face? So I like to think that 28 years later that we've proven that we can do it. But the whole idea of government advocacy has been something. I mean, it's very historical. It's very traditional in the community. I mean, even in Tanakh, we find different kinds of versions of government advocacy. And yesterday, I like reading history, and I was reading articles yesterday about how a primary role of the Sanhedrin was to represent the people to the Romans and to other outside groups. And throughout history, prominent Rabbanim and Gedolei Yisrael advocated on behalf of the Jewish people. Some were members of parliament themselves. And this was the case all the way up until the 20th century, and when the Agudah was created a little bit more than 100 years ago, obviously government advocacy was going to be part of that. And it was. Particularly this was coming with the rise of communism, and things in Europe were changing, so a lot of what the Agudah was doing as it formed was government advocacy. And that's in Europe. And here in the United States, when the young, it was really a youth movement here, when they started becoming active in the 30s and the 40s, well, it was all around the Holocaust time. So much of their work had to do with pre-Holocaust, during the Holocaust, and post-Holocaust activities, mostly dealing with refugees, mostly dealing with survivors. mostly dealing with rescue. So our roots here in America have included in large measure government advocacy. And going to Washington, like I said, you know, the organization's been here for, you know, since the 30s. But I guess the feeling was among our leadership was that, you know, if you really want to have an effect on public policy and legislation, in this day and age, you have to be in Washington. And you have to be where the, you know, it's like, if you want the challah to taste good, you got to be in the kitchen when you're mixing the ingredients. And that's exactly the case. I mean, because when you're there, you know, I thought I'd 27 years ago, I thought I'd start and it'd be slow and I'd have to sort of work myself into offices, but it didn't end up that way at all. On the contrary, I was getting phone calls from organizations or people in government inviting me to, you know, join this effort or join that effort or give input on this or that issue. So you know, being in Washington was a big step, but it really heightened our involvement in government advocacy. I just want to say also that this is very integral to the Agora and every part of its work, but particularly in government advocacy. Our policy decision making is different than many, if not most, of other organizational decision making. I used to work for the Anti-Defamation League many years ago. So like many organizations, you have a professional staff, you know, an executive staff, and you have a lay leadership, and the lay leadership particularly, you know, they primarily determine your policy. You know, the lay leaders get together, they form committees, they undertake issues, and they set policy. In the Agora, our policy is set by what we call rabbinic governing boards. Our policies are set by the Moetzes Gedolei HaTorah, which is in English is translated as the Council for Torah Sages. And the central unifying force of the Agora is that our decisions should be made by prominent Rabbanim and Rosh Yeshiva on the basis of Das Torah. So the Das Torah, you know, I'm not sure that there's a good definition of the term Das Torah. Das Torah is according to the Torah's thinking, according to the Torah's perspective. And this is, you know, there's nothing magical about this. It's not like, you know, they're abundant, you know, this is magic or that they're infallible. But obviously we have, you know, we have chosen, not we have chosen, because the members of the Moetzes choose themselves. They're a self-perpetuating body, so if they're vacancies on the Moetzes, the other members decide who else comes on to it. But the idea is that individuals whose entire lives and whose entire days have been devoted to Torah learning and Torah thinking and hashkafa and halacha, after a while, incorporate within their own thinking, you know, what the Torah's thoughts might be on particular issues. And that's not only true in halacha, it's obvious for obviously true in halacha, but it's true on every issue, and that includes even public policy, even government advocacy. So when we have an issue, you know, whatever the issues are today, you know, you can pick them, you know, healthcare and immigration or whatever, our central governing body, the governing body that makes policy for us, are our Rabbanim, and they are among the most prominent Rabbanim in the world. And in that way, we feel confident that we are doing things al das Torah and al pi Torah, and to the extent that there are other, for example, there might be, you know, if a question needs some scientific input, as many questions do, medical input or scientific or other kinds of input. So that is the role of our lay leadership, and we have leadership that is active in many different areas, and whether it's a question in accounting or a question in science or whatever it might be, they make presentations to the Moetzes Gedolei HaTorah So the Moetsis will have the information they need to be able to make this, make the decisions that they need. And I have to say, they're quite contemporary. I mean, you know, you think these are old world people, and of course, in many respects, they are. But their grasp of you know, modern events and modern concepts is really second to none. And I think that and I think, you know, that, well, as I said, that's like a central, that's a central, it's a fundamental building block to what the Agoda is and why we exist. That's our raison d'etre. That, you know, if you want lay leaders to determine your policies, there are many organizations that can provide that. But we who believe that our leadership is the Gedolei Yisrael and it should be based on decisions of the Gedolei Yisrael, based on Torah, this is the way we operate. You know, sometimes the Moetsis will speak in specifics, like a specific question. Sometimes they will just set out general principles, and then the staff and others, you know, we don't go to, you know, every time there's a little issue of a language and a piece of legislation, we don't go and ask them. But if they set out principles, then when we do our best to follow them. And I think that we were talking about this before. I think to some extent, because you can ask, like, why do politicians listen to us? I mean, we don't have great numbers. In some districts, we're completely invisible, right? We're not big, you know, contributors to campaigns. And I would say, and I think this is true, I think that a lot of it has to do with the fact that they feel that they are, when they see the organization and how it's run, on the basis upon which it's run, they appreciate the fact that these are centuries-old traditional values that are being brought to the table, that are being brought into the discussion. And I, you know, I've been in Washington 28 years. I mentioned before I was actually born in Washington. You know, but I'm not jaded. I do think that most politicians still want to do good, and they appreciate different viewpoints, and they particularly appreciate Jewish viewpoints. And I think the fact that they see us as traditional and you know, philosophically based, they also see us as not wavering on issues. You know, there are a lot of organizations that, you know, depending on the prevailing winds, they might take this position one day and take another position another day or another year or whatever. And we just don't have that in our organization. I mean, if circumstances change, that's something else. But our basic philosophy, the philosophies, the hashkafos that we bring to the table are set, and they don't. You know, they don't just blow, you know, we don't go as the wind is blowing. And I've said this comment before, and it's funny. I don't mean, it's a funny thing to say, but it's true. People in Washington, whether it's in the White House or whether it's in Congress, they want Jews to be Jewish. They want Jews to be Jewish. They sense when somebody is Jewish and you're giving me a Jewish view. You're giving me, I mean, I've had people... I've had staffers come over to me after reading testimony that we put in and others in the Jewish community and outside of the Jewish community put in, and they would come over and say, you know, yours was the only one that had Jewish sources. You know, yours was the only testimony that included, you know, quotes from the Bible or the Talmud or whatever. And so I think they appreciate that. I think they recognize that, and that's a particularly true of conservatives, of evangelicals. They want Jews to be Jewish, and they want to feel that when they're going to a Jewish organization, they're getting Jewish religious thinking. And I think that's we provide that to them. So I just want to talk also a little bit about our agenda. I think probably 40% of my day, my typical day, is spent on education issues. And which tells you a lot. It tells you, number one, tells them that how important chinuch is to us, And it tells us how much work there is to do in Washington on these kinds of issues. And because to us, I mean, our yeshivas, our day schools, those are our crown jewels. Those are, you know, that's what, you know, people, I always find it interesting that the Jewish community organizations talk about, you know, they're worrying about the key to Jewish continuity and continuity and continuity. But we all know that education is the key to Jewish continuity and Jewish survival. So you would think that would be way up on the community, you know, agenda. But it's not. It is number one on our agenda because we appreciate that fact, and our yeshivas and day schools are like I said, our crown jewels. So we spend a good 40%, and that's a big chunk of our work in Washington on that. As a matter of fact, on Friday, I was invited to a meeting with the new Secretary of Education. She invited a number of interest groups down to, like, you know, talk about what plans are in the works and how everybody will fit into those plans. When I say education, I mean, number one, paying for education, which is obviously an issue everywhere. So that could be financial assistance through federal programs, or it could be the concept of school choice, you know, whether it's vouchers or tax credits. You know, there are different forms of assistance that our yeshivas can get. It could be special ed, it could be remedial education. I mean, our yeshivas are entitled to many programs. They don't always get what they're entitled to, and that's part of our job too, to make sure that they're getting what they're entitled to. So that's one part of education. Another part of education that we've been involved in is the autonomy of our institutions. Because, you know, when you get assistance from the government, there are strings attached to that assistance. And strings are fine, but at the same time, our schools, like Catholic schools and other schools, have been created for a mission, you know, to fulfill a certain mission. And they're there for a purpose. So, you know, if you know, health and safety issues, regulations, of course, that makes sense. But now, the government is getting into areas of curriculum, you know, things that you might have to teach, which might be objectionable to us on religious grounds, or hiring policies, which has become an extremely, extremely big issue now, particularly in this age of gay marriage and gay rights, where, you know, our schools might want to adhere to certain hiring policies that conform with our religious beliefs. And, you know, that's, you know, that means that they might not be able to have the same kinds of policies that secular organizations do. So education, when I say education, it's a very broad topic. But that's the bulk of what we do, and that's, you know, that's, like I said, it's indicative of how important it is to us and how much work there is to do there. A lot of education, I have to say, is state level. I mean, it's really, education is mostly a state issue, but there are federal components to it, and they're very important. Those are the things I deal with. I have some colleagues that deal with education on the state level. A colleague of mine, Rabbi Ariel Sadwin, I don't know if you've heard the name, but he deals in Maryland, and he also deals in Pennsylvania and Virginia.
Came to Richmond. And came to Richmond, the General Assembly.
Came, yeah. So, you know, so he's working on the state level on the various state issues. And they you know, they're different kinds of issues, but they're just as critical to the schools. So the other broad area that we deal with, I mean, needless to say, is religious liberty issues. Religious liberty issues. And, you know, we still have issues with Shmirah Shabbos, Shmirah Yantif. We still have issues. There are laws on the books.
Davening Mincha.
Different kinds of accommodations. Actually, we had a thing in terms of davening a few years ago. It was a little different kind of issue. It was an issue of daylight savings time. Because they wanted to expand daylight savings time, or standard time. They wanted to expand it in a way that would have made the times for tefillah, like 9 a.m. So you couldn't possibly have a minion and then go to work afterwards. So, you know, we have these kinds of situations that come up. And a lot of people were complaining about that, by the way. Yeah, right. So we have, you know, Shemira Shabbos issues still. We have issues, even with Shechita and Kashrus. Issues, there's laws on the books, but sometimes the way they've been interpreted, and now particularly with the pressures from groups like PETA and Mr. Morfolk.
Yeah, right.
That's really what we're meeting with. I remember when I took that boat ride, we passed it out there. So there's a lot of pressure.
Ringling Brothers loves coming.
So there's a lot of pressures. Even nowadays, you know, healthcare. We had issues in healthcare. I mean, there were some religious issues that didn't affect us so much, but on principle, they affected us. For example, in Obamacare, there was the contraceptive mandate, which would have forced orders, of, you know, sisters' orders that do good works in different communities, to provide their employee with contraceptive devices that are against their religious beliefs. Or in other situations that we were affected by this, it would require doctors to participate in, as they call them, gender reassignment surgeries, which we know as sex change operations. So even in healthcare, I mean, you're like, I'm just giving examples of, like, in all kinds of different areas, there are religious freedom issues that are being implicated, and as I indicated before, the rights of religious organizations, there was a Washington State Supreme Court decision that was handed down the other day about a florist who didn't want to provide flowers to a gay wedding, you know, and we had that with caterers. As a matter of fact, here in Baltimore, the Star K is now involved in an issue like that. It affects our schools, it affects our shuls, it can affect all kinds of our caterers, you know. Those are the kinds of things, this tension between, you know, religious rights and other rights, sometimes there's tension, and they have to be worked out. I mean, nobody's looking to take people's rights away, but you have to do the proper balance so that everybody gets the protections that they deserve. So, you know, religious liberty issues continue, and, you know, whether it's gender bathrooms, whether, you know, you could just tick off the list of issues that, you know, that religious liberty is still an issue almost on a day-to-day basis. And finally, I mean, there are many more areas, but obviously the other area that comes to mind is Israel and you know, international affairs. I mean, obviously Israel is the number one issue of the community, and things are never dull when it comes to Israel. But also, you know, we've seen an uptick in anti-Semitism around the world over the last few years. Of course, you can't always separate the Israel issue from the anti-Semitism issue, even though some people want to do that. You know, I'm not an anti-Semite, I just don't like what Israel's doing. You know, there's a fine line. And also there's the security of Jewish communities around the world. And by the way, when during this past immigration executive order issue, I have to say that I did receive a lot of phone calls from the Iranian Jewish community here who were very concerned about how that would affect them and other communities, but particularly the Iranian Jewish community. Obviously, Iran has a special status. We're concerned about the physical safety of Jews overseas, and also, and this has been true of recent years, of their religious, their religious rights, because there have been threats to Shechita, in different countries in Europe and in New Zealand and other places.
San Francisco.
Well, that, and Bris Mila. So Shchita and Bris Mila have been put in jeopardy in a number of countries. And, you know, you think, well, there might be good reasons, there might be reasonable reasons, secular reasons. But historically, people have asked, you know, why are you still getting so concerned about, you know, Shchita and Bris Mila? Well, historically, Shchita and Bris Mila have always been the first things that governments have attacked when bad things followed later on. It's interesting, even with the Nazis, you know, Shchita was one of the first things that, when the Aguda was formed back in the 30s, one of the first things they dealt with was the threat against Shchita. And we know in Jewish history in general, you know, whether it's Bris Mila or Shchita.
That was the first thing by Yitzchak Mitzrayim.
By Yitzchak Mitzrayim, and also by the Korban time, after the Korban time, by the Greeks. So anyway, so those are, you know, some of the broader areas. That are, like I said, there are a lot of small areas. We help individuals if they have issues that they're having a hard time wading through government. We help people. We try to help people on discrimination issues. So I really want to stop, and maybe if you have any questions, but I'll just say that at the end there was a Rabbi Scherer. Rabbi Moshe Scherer was the head of the Aguda for 50 years, and he wrote a book, and in his book he writes that there was a very good Supreme Court decision that had come down that he thought would help the yeshivas a great deal in terms of their autonomy and financial aid. However, the Congress, the next right, turned around and in a sense overruled the Supreme Court. So he was very, very depressed, and, you know, he'd worked very long and hard on these issues, and they really were going to the benefit of the yeshivas. So he got a letter from Rabbi Huttner, who was the Rosh Yeshiva of Chaim Berlin at the time. And what he said to him was, you have to understand our thinking, right? Jewish, our thinking in the Jewish world. And that is, our job is not, it can't be judged on accomplishment. Our job is to try. We have to make an effort. That's why even in our business, somebody like myself, we're called shtadlanim, which in Hebrew means people that try. We try to do our best, but you know, we make the arguments and we advocate to people and we have our meetings and we have to do all that because that's our responsibility as shtadlanim, and people that do it professionally have to do it, and people that are in the communities have to do it. As a matter of fact, I can tell you right now that the people who do it professionally and myself cannot really do it without the people in the communities. Because, you know, somebody can look at me from today till tomorrow, but unless he sees a community behind, it's not going to mean very much. And it's very important, I would just say, that, you know, if you have, everybody has elected officials, to bring them into the schools, to bring them into the shuls, develop a personal relationship with them. And that's what we do with Shtadlanim. We try. And, you know, ultimately, we know that these things are not in our hands. The accomplishment is really in the hands of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, who's the Mamlech Malachim. He's the one who decides who rules and who gets the say and whose legislation gets passed and that it doesn't get passed. But it's our challenge to try and to work hard and continue this work on behalf of our entire community.
Thanks for the question.
Sure.
Yeah. Like the good shoes.